So hello and welcome back. I hope you had a nice break. Well, I did. Excuse me. Bought myself some more coffee. This is not, there's not depicted an invasive species, by the way, because it's from Thailand, where the Asian elephant is an endemic species. Anyway, before the break, we spoke, about species invasion and the mobility of species, deliberate or not. I emphasized the shift in the predominant view on species invasion and species movement from predominantly, mainly being something positive, something deliberate, part of the European quest for control and profits, and the optimistic view, not least of the Victorian age, as we call it in Northwestern Europe, regarding the ability of humanity, mainly white men from certain countries, okay, to transform the world for their own benefit, to contemporary sensibility concerning the vulnerability of ecosystems, the disruptive effects of foreign non-endemic species, and possibly a yearning towards something which is pristine and authentic. So today I'll move on to the other related phenomenon, namely that of extinction. Okay, so extinctions have taken place before. After all, I mean, this book is called The Sixth Extinction. So there were five previous mass extinctions on the planet. The last being the famous, rather well-known event that took place 65 million years ago, where the dinosaurs, by and large, disappeared. Well, in a way, dinosaurs survived. Birds are flying dinosaurs. There are very large lizards, mainly on the oceanic islands where they didn't have natural enemies, where there were not many mammals, so such as the Komodo lizard, which lives on four smallish islands in Indonesia, largest lizard in the world. But on the whole, you know, they disappeared and they gave way to the mammals 65 million years ago. But that's a long time ago, and it was the result of a natural disaster. A beto landed on Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. The sixth extinction that Elizabeth Colbert wrote about a few years ago in a book which has received a lot of deserved attention, had been translated into many languages, including Norwegian, is about the ongoing extinction that takes place now, which is largely a result of human success being too, you know, too successful, human success being too comprehensive, too good for the planet. We've been too successful for our own good and for that of the rest of the planet, dominating the world and bringing other species to extinction. So let's take a step back. When did nature cease being the other, something that had to be conquered, something that had to be dominated by human beings? Well, as many anthropologists, all anthropologists really, who have done their homework would be able to tell you, it is not the case in every society, even today, that nature is considered the other. Many, not least small stateless peoples, to the extent that they still exist, horticulturalists, hunters and gatherers, regard nature as an extension of themselves. They regard nature as a subject, as something that you deal with, that you rely on, that you depend on, that you have responsibilities for. So there's a sense of stewardship rather than ownership regarding nature in many parts of the world. And this would probably have been the norm in the pre-agricultural world. With agriculture, nature or parts of nature became the enemy. Weeds, you know, that destroy your crops. In African agriculture, baboons and elephants, a continuous problem, you know, for anybody who tries to grow foodstuffs. Dangerous animals, poisonous snakes, erratic weather, storms, droughts, flooding. Nature, something dreadful that needed to be controlled. And even today, after the onset of the Anthropocene, when we are beginning to understand how much damage humanity is doing to the ecosystems of the planet, even today, a rather widespread view and a very sort of popular attitude to climate change mitigation or solutions to the problems of climate change consist in various forms of geoengineering. In other words, more technology of the same kind will help solve this problem, such as placing particles in the atmosphere that weaken the impact of the sun rays and thereby, you know, slow down or even neutralize global warming, that sort of thing. But something happened to the predominant attitude towards nature in the hegemonic North Atlantic part of the world and also elsewhere. When it gradually dawned upon us that we are, you know, creating a lot of lasting problems of an ecological kind, and it will come back to us with a vengeance, because we're losing diversity, we're losing maybe some of the sources of our livelihoods through environmental destruction, bringing other species to extinction, losing flexibility, losing opportunities for the future, and also losing the very aesthetic experience of having something outside yourself, which is not, as it were, produced by humans that you can relate to and revel in, and which is part of the miracle of creation. So the term nature conservation, which became popular in the 1970s, not such a long time ago. It had existed before. People had been thinking ecologically and been worrying about the effects of industrialism since the beginning of industrialism. But it took off and became a more sort of more mainstream view from the 1970s. Nature conservation, why? Well, nature suddenly became something weak and vulnerable, not something strong and threatening, but weak and vulnerable. It needed the protection of humans. Culture was needed to save nature. And that is something new. This shift has been described, it hasn't been described as much as it should be, but it does come up in a book by Marilyn Strathern, published in the early 90s, called After Nature, which is also about kinship and about many other things. But she also has some very acute remarks and some really good analysis, as is so often the case in Marilyn Strathern's writings, about the way in which nature suddenly became something that you needed to protect, because you couldn't take it for granted anymore. Such had human domination become. And that is also one way of thinking about the Anthropocene as a phenomenon and as a period in the history of the world. It is a period when one species somehow has taken leadership and has belatedly come to discover that it's undermining the conditions for its own existence. It's digging its own grave. It's painting itself into a corner because it hasn't been looking after all the non-human species, all the intricate webs that connect us to the rest of the living world and that of the dead world, such as water. So, changes, accelerated change, overheating and extinction taking place quickly in the last, say, 50 years or so. It's accelerated. The increased dominance of human activity and of human beings on the planet. I mean, look at this diagram based on the research published only a couple of years ago. So these are the mammals in the world now, in numbers. 4% are wild mammals, 36% humans, and 60% are mammals owned by humans. Cattle, pigs, sheep, but also dogs and cats. And this does say something, doesn't it, about the state of the world today. You know, were you to produce a similar graph 100, 150 years ago, it would have looked very different. For one thing, there were far fewer humans. And for another, there were far more wild animals. There were more wildernesses, proper wildernesses, not encroached upon by human activity. And they're dwindling. And here's the avian diagram. 70% are chickens and other poultry, humanly owned animals. 30% are wild. Well, not as bad regarding the bird kingdom as the animal or mammal kingdom, but even so, 70% of the birds in the world are mainly chickens. That's, you know, it is worth reflecting upon the implications of this shift. And it shows the significance of the term nature conservation. Nature needs to be protected because you can no longer assume that it will look after itself and even be a threat to human existence. Unless you count bacteria and viruses that I'm going to talk about in a couple of weeks as part of nature, which perhaps we should. But larger creatures, but also smaller creatures, such as beetles, bees, you know, there's been a massive death of, you know, bees. I mean, what is called colony collapse. Still a little bit mysterious, the causes of colony collapse. There are several hypotheses. Agriculture, pesticides, monocultures. But one isn't quite sure whether this is the main cause of the colony collapse. So anyway, here's a quotation from a research article. Humanity has wiped out 60% of mammals, birds, fish and reptiles since 1970. That's quite a bit, isn't it? It's oversimplifying a bit because one has to be more nuanced. Which species are we talking about? Which habitats? Yes, I mean, in some parts of the world where there used to be wolves, there are no longer wolves. But in other parts of the world, there are lots of wolves. So this does not mean that virtually every wild animal species is threatened by extinction, but quite a few are, not least some of the larger ones. The tiger, the rhinoceros, and so on, which were not endangered in 1970. But you know, if you live in an area in India, and there has been population growth, and there's been agricultural expansion, and you move into an area near a forest where there are tigers, you don't want those tigers to eat your bullocks or your children. You want to shoot them. Some of these large mammals may, by 2050, exist only in zoos. You know, so they would have been incorporated into the realm of culture, where they were formerly outside it, safely outside, threatening it and posing, you know, a real sort of alternative world. So, let's move on. This really nice book that I mentioned briefly by Janice Marie Sodikoff. I know little about her. I think she's a fairly young anthropologist who has been looking at the parallels, the similarities between various forms of extinction. So the book of which you have been asked only to read the first chapter, but feel free to read the rest of it. I think you have electronic access to the entire book. Tries to draw some lines between different forms of death, different forms of extinction. And what I'm interested in this context is to look at it from the perspective of overheating. overheating and the Anthropocene, the accelerated changes produced by human beings and their effects on linguistic diversity, cultural diversity, and biodiversity. And it has often struck me when talking to biologists who work with invasion and extinction, you know, who have an ecological framework for their work, because many biologists work in very different fields. It's often struck me that the way they talk about biodiversity is quite similar to the way in which anthropologists often talk about cultural diversity. We would argue that the loss of a cultural world, when it is forgotten, the last speaker of a language dies. The customs, the traditions, the myths, the ways of going about things, the techniques, the agricultural knowledge, which is experience-based, all of this goes away. It reduces the scope, the wealth, the richness of the human world, but it also takes away future options because we lose alternatives. At the end, we end up with Margaret Thatcher's world, TINA, there is no alternative to neoliberal global capitalism. I think many anthropologists are motivated by showing that TINA is wrong, TAMA is right. There are many alternatives. And the number of these alternatives are seemingly decreasing in an overheated world. And, I would rattle off something about along these lines, okay? And the biologist, you know, sipping his coffee, would sort of look out of the window and say that, yeah, this is pretty much what I would have said about biodiversity. We lose future options. So it's bad, of course, for the species as such. It's bad for the ecosystem as such, but it's also very bad for humanity. And the loss of flexibility. Remember, I spoke about flexibility in one of the first lectures as uncommitted potential for change, elbow room, the options, the opportunities, the possibilities you have. And the more energy you commit, the more energy you harness in your environment, and the more of the resources in your environment that are not only potentially used, but are actually being used, the less options you have for the future. You become less and less flexible regarding the possibility for change. So biodiversity and cultural diversity can be compared along these lines, at least up to a point. So the forms of loss. Now, who is this? This is, would you know, an artist's imagination of what it might have looked like on my favorite island, Mauritius, in the mid-17th century, before explanation, before colonization by first the Portuguese, then the Dutch, eventually the French, who arrived in 1715, after the island was abandoned by the Portuguese and by the Dutch, who gave up colonizing it. It was a bit remote, you know, it was difficult, it was expensive to keep, and so on. But the French came in a big way, and they brought slaves, and they started to produce sugar, and they used Port-Louis, the capital, which has a good deep port, a sheltered good deep port, lies in a bay in northwestern Mauritius, as a trading port, halfway between South Africa and India. The dodo. You may have heard the expression, dead as a dodo, something which is gone and it's not going to return. Unless, of course, someone takes its DNA, finds its DNA and produces a dodo in the laboratory in a possibly near future. But the dodo was a big, flightless bird. Just as I said, I mean, the Komodo lizard, the large lizards, large reptiles. I mean, such as the Galapagos tortoises, you know, the largest land tortoises on Earth. And there are other large land tortoises also on the Aldabra archipelago, an archipelago of coral islands, halfway between the Seychelles and Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. Also huge tortoises. And how did they survive when they died out everywhere else? Well, because they were on isolated oceanic islands where they had no natural enemies. such as pesky rats who ate their eggs, or you know, other predators. So they were well adapted to their environment, because the environment did not contain those mammals. The dodo, similarly, lived on the island of Mauritius, far away from everything else. Didn't have any natural enemies. There were no predators. There were no wolf equivalents or fox equivalents or bear or tiger or lion equivalents in Mauritius. So they were going about their business in a very peaceful way. They were fattish, as you could see. They had a lot of meat on them. They couldn't fly. They were slow. They were unafraid. They walked up to people, and the people came with a club and killed them one by one and ate them for supper. And before you knew it, there were no dodos left. There are a few left now, but stuffed dodos. One of them is in the museum in Mauritius, one in Britain, and the third, I'm not sure. So you see, that does a dodo. So that's one famous example of very rapid species extinction owing to human intervention. But there are many other examples. We talk about thousands of species that have gone extinct in living memory. So this is why Elizabeth Colbert's book is called The Sixth Extinction. She feels that there is something going on now. And if you take the broader and the larger view, you will find that certain species which are not being hunted, you know, which are not being killed deliberately, are losing their habitats, which is a very common way of marginalizing a species, losing their habitats owing to agricultural and industrial and urban expansion. The climate is changing, making life difficult for the polar bears, for example. You would all have seen that iconic image of the polar bear, you know, on a shrinking sort of ice floe, floating in the Arctic Ocean, and seemingly wondering what's going to happen next, because they depend on sea ice in order to hunt seals, right? So if the habitat changes owing to climate change, some species are also going to have a hard time. Now, the optimistic view would be that, well, but then other species will eventually evolve and we will have a new form of diversity. Yes, if you have the patience to wait for a few million years, that's probably going to happen. But not in this century and not in the next, because evolution, you know, natural selection, evolution by natural selection is slow. And the eradication of species by human intervention is fast. You can think of it like this. If you think of history and of the time scales we operate within as a clock, you know, you have the hour hand, the small hand, which moves really slowly. Then you have the minute hand, which moves a bit faster. And then the second hand, which goes full circle in 1 minute. We operate at the level of the second hand, and even faster than that, maybe at the level of the nanosecond. But let's say we move at the speed of the second hand in cultural change. And the second hand is moving a bit faster now than it did before 1991 and before the onset of the fossil fuel revolution a couple of hundred years earlier. But we operate within that time scale. That's historical time. Then you have the time of archaeology, perhaps. The minute hand. You can go back to human remains or pre-human remains, maybe a few million years. You can go to Ethiopia, discover Lucy, you know, the first anthropoid, it's a rather small ape-like creature, but she was sort of, you know, she was our ancestress 7 million years ago. Or you could operate within the hour hand scale and think in terms of millions of years, rather than thousands or hundreds or tens. Okay, so things are taking place really quickly now regarding the changes that we bring about on the planet, and the planet is probably going to take a long time, you know, adjusting, recovering, returning to a kind of diversity which resembles that which existed before the current era. Okay, genocide. There are parallels in colonial history. between species extinction and genocide. I mean, the predominant ideology, not only in the United States, but perhaps most outspokenly and most clearly in the United States, was that you had a vast expanse to the West. Go West, young man, to the West. A vast expanse, as late as the 19th century, which had been, which was underutilized, which had not yet been conquered, which had not yet been colonized, and which could be, you know, subjected to human domination. There were people living there, but they were politically weaker than you, and they didn't have guns in most cases. They could be subjugated, exterminated, put into reservations, whatever. And so you could, and you could kill off the bisons, and you could grow wheat and make money. It's a short version of something, some of the things that happened in the so-called opening of the West, but not only in America. I mean, you had a similar ideology in Russia. The vast expanses to the east, full of minerals, timber, and other resources. Well, there were also people living already, but they were also small groups and politically weaker than the Russian state. So this perspective, it made it possible, and even made it possible to defend not only the sort of the geoengineering of the surface. Rip away the forest, the prairie, the animals that live there, and produce food, bring in cattle. The American cowboy, the central figure in American mythology, was historically someone who, in a rather short period, I think maybe basically 1850s to the 1870s or so, brought large herds of cattle. That's what the cowboy did. Thus the name cowboy. The cowboys brought cattle, some of them to be slaughtered in the new bustling multicultural city of Chicago, the meat capital, but some of them were just brought to new pastures further west. You know, they had been purchased by landowners who needed, you know, to fill up their land with something that could generate profits. So in that process, you know, that sort of geoengineering of the planet is not entirely new, but it's accelerated. There's more of it, and the price to pay was that the societies that already existed there vanished. Some of the people survived, but under very different circumstances, because they ceased being self-reproducing societies. They were brought into reservations and were turned into some kind of colonial vassals. And genocide also happened. I mean, in Australia, in the Americas, and elsewhere. So the genocide, the physical eradication of native populations, could be the order of the day in many cases, just as the eradication of species. So that's part of the history of Western civilization. Now increasingly global civilization. Now, Dipesh Chakrabarty, a very influential and powerful Indian historian, quoted by Sodikov, pointing out, he's one of the historians of the Anthropocene who's been arguing consistently for many years that in order to understand human history, we have to think ecologically. We also have to think about disparities in power. Ecology, colonial history, and the history of humanity have to be brought together. And he points out that owing to the increasing awareness of the fact that we human beings are part of ecosystems, we're not outside, has led to a collapse of the distinction between culture and nature. We have to look at the life world in which we live as human beings, as something consisting of not just humans, but also everything else, and that there is a dynamic relationship between us and that everything else. And I belong to those who believe that this realization, the realization that we are ecological creatures, is a game changer. You know, it shifts the gaze, and it is bound to have an impact on future anthropology. So, I mean, if I were to write my textbook in anthropology, small places, large issues now, it would have to take in the Anthropocene, probably from the first chapter onwards. And maybe there will be a new one. And if there is a new Small Places, Large Issues, it's going to take in that the realization of the Anthropocene in a big way. Not everything is affected. You can write about Goffman, you can write about role theory, you can write about political dominance, and so on, without taking in ecology. But there are so many of the things that we do which retrospectively have an ecological component and an ecological implication which has been ignored in the past, that we should take this seriously. This is not just anthropology. Now a footnote. Footnote one. The influential environmental philosopher Arne Johan Vetlesen published a book only last year called Cosmologies of the Anthropocene. And it's a book which is not just interesting to philosophers, but also to anthropologists, because he engages with recent anthropological theorizing about the culture-nature relationship. And that's not what I was going to say. Well, I mean, this is an advert for the book, okay? If you have the time, if you have the inclination, take a look at it, if you're interested in that sort of thing. But what I was going to say is that he writes in the introduction that, you know, when he studied philosophy at this university, University of Oslo, but also at the University of Frankfurt, where he studied with the famous philosopher Jürgen Habermas, nobody ever mentioned nature. And that's pretty, you know, that's pretty strong. We fared slightly better in anthropology. He and I are about the same age, so we studied parallel subjects. He took a bit of anthropology, I took a bit of philosophy. You know, I became one and he became the other. But in anthropology, we were a little bit better. We did have texts about ecology, but it was not integrated into the way we think. Just as the feminist revolution, to some extent, in the 70s and 80s, led to feminist perspective, gender perspectives, being integrated into parts of anthropological and other social science thinking where it had been ignored until then. Suddenly you noticed, you discovered that, in fact, gender is part of this world and needs to be integrated as a natural part of the analysis. In the same way, I think that ecological thinking something similar will happen to that. Anyway, let me move on quickly. Natural selection, the principle of evolution, which is very, very simple. I mean, natural selection simply implies that there are more offspring in any given population of any given species than will be able to reproduce. So there will be, in a sense, competition, right? To be the ones that reproduce. Adaptation, or rather success, depends not merely on your inherent qualities, but on your adaptation to a particular environment, which means that characteristics which may be adaptive in one environment cease to be adaptive if you move to another one. If you have really big horns, for example, it's good on the savannah. And it helps you, you know, reproduce, okay, because all the females would admire you. I mean, males tend to be the ones with the big horns, because in the theory of sexual selection, it's always the females who do the selection. And so the males have to show off in order to be the ones who are selected by the females. So that would be good on the savannah. But suppose you move into a forest, or there's climate change, so suddenly there's a dense forest. Having big horns is very inconvenient. You find it's hard for you to move around. So suddenly what was adaptive and the key to evolutionary success in the savannah ceases to be in the forest. This is an insight which can be transferred to other domains as well, and which makes sense in the human world also. So does it apply to language and cultural forms? I say yes and no, because on the one hand, Alfred Kroeber, quoted by Sodikov, is perfectly right in, early 20th century anthropologist, one of Franz Boas's first students, PhD 1901. And he was also the father of the famous science fiction author Ursula Le Guin, who died a couple of years ago. and whose works, whose books have a very strong anthropological component. She knew a thing or two about culture. But Kroeber's view was that culture is super organic. It's above the organic. It's autonomous. Yeah, I guess so. But that does not mean that the same mechanisms do not apply to culture regarding selective pressure and so on, than to nature. Because it's self-evidently true that if you have two different cultural practices and one somehow works better for you than the other, that will eventually win out. So, yeah. I'm not sure, because sometimes power comes in, deliberate planning comes in, artificial selection, as it were. Human interventions leapfrog, or they can neutralize the constraints of natural selection. Human interventions, for example, include modern medicine, which is very anti-Darwinian. You know, many of us would not have been here had it not been for modern medicine. We would have been selected away as too weak because we got diseases, or we were short-sighted, so we couldn't, you know, see the prey from a distance. And nobody wanted to mother our children as men, you know. And as women, you would have similar, you know, didn't have the right kinds of skills to survive. And maybe some kind of innate disease or whatever. And with modern medicine, that can be controlled. You know, it can be cured. So modern medicine is very anti-Darwinian. It helps people to survive who would have died had there just been natural selection. So don't tell me that natural selection is the order of the day in human society. We do things deliberately in order to neutralize the undesirable effects of natural selection through artificial selection, you might say. Well, I mentioned law. You know, law is also a human intervention that shapes our behavior, creates norms, values, which do not sort of grow out of anything biological. And selective breeding of livestock, pets. Fun fact. In Darwin's famous book, The Origin of the Species, which is a very good book, it's much better than much of the neo-Darwinist literature that's been published more recently, from 1859, he devotes a lot of attention to the breeding of pigeons. And in fact, he went into those, you know, seedy establishments, places in eastern London, where people were, you know, drinking gin, and rough people, you know, who were breeding pigeons, competitive pigeons, you know, to win competitions. And he saw, you know, how they through experience-based crossbreeding between different pigeons, how they managed to breed out the, you know, the best characters, the most beautiful feathers, the nicest beak, and so on, through selective breeding. So they accelerated the process of natural selection. They wanted them to be adapted, not to a natural environment, but to the environment of the competition where prizes were given. Similarly with livestock, you know, the cattle that we've got here, they are bred either to produce a lot of milk, as NRF, you know, Norsk Rødtfe, the only breed of cattle existing in Norway for decades after the Second World War, because milk was supposed to be good for you. Meat could be eaten, but it wasn't world class. In other parts of the world, selective breeding of cattle has produced cows that are really, or calves, which are really tasty. In a third part of the world, cattle maybe have been bred for the oxen to be as strong as possible, to be able to pull carts and plows, and to be used, you know, as draft animals in agriculture. So this happens. And think about pets, you know, the Dalmatian and the Chihuahua. They both belong to the same species. They're dogs, and have been bred selectively very quickly. That sort of diversity would never have occurred through natural selection. So in other words, I'm concentrating here on the distinguishing between deliberate choice, which we human beings are really good at, although we never foresee the consequences. Many of our decisions, many of the choices we make have unintended consequences, but we do make deliberate choices, planning and so on, versus stochastic, which is the technical term for a kind of random process that you see in nature. And in natural selection, genetic diversity and variation within a species is just thrown out in the open. I mean, you have all sorts of variations, and a few of them turn out to be good in that particular environment. And those who possess those characteristics would, you know, they would have more offspring, and before you know of it, your particular gene pool predominates. And this sort of stochastic process, it's very slow. It's like shooting blindfolded with a shotgun. Sooner or later, you're going to hit the target, but it's going to take a long while. As opposed to the marksman with a rifle and with a sharp eyesight, you shoot once and you hit the target. You see the difference. So there's a difference here between what happens in nature and what happens through human intervention. But the species extinctions and the invasive species that I've spoken about are mainly the result of side effects of deliberate choices. And this is why they've accelerated. That's why it's happening so fast. Now, sometimes these different sort of strands, these different processes are entangled with each other. What I spoke about before the break, the protection of endemic species, endemic ecosystems, and the protection of endemic local cultures. And also a little while ago I drew the parallel between biodiversity and cultural diversity. Well, it is commonly agreed upon in the United Nations and among and in the a large part of the NGO development world that on the whole one should try to allow indigenous peoples to stay indigenous, at least to the extent that they themselves wish to be in command of their own cultural dynamics. But it's tricky, you see, because some of these indigenous groups, they perform actions which are seen as objectionable in the NGO world and in the United Nations. They violate human rights all the time. For example, I mean, in the child raising and the way they go about making enemies and so on, they may violate human rights. And that's part of the culture, it's part of the tradition. And is it therefore immune to criticism? Probably not, but there's no easy way out. The image I'm showing you here, you see what it is. You know, the whale, in almost every country in the world except Norway and a couple of other, like Iceland, Japan, the whale is almost considered a sacred animal. It should not be hunted, should not be eaten. It should be revered and respected and admired. But, indigenous groups like these Inuits in Alaska, they hunt whales and eat them, and they've done so forever. So there's a tricky balance here. But this particular Inuit group agreed decades ago to put a moratorium on the hunting of, I can't remember which species, one particular whale species which was considered endangered. So they agreed to do that. So in other words, a compromise between tradition and the pressure from the outside world. And they also realized that if we go on doing this, there aren't going to be any whales left for the next generations. So they allowed the whale population to recover and then took it up again. Greenpeace is none too pleased with this. Others are also none too pleased with it. But it's hard to condemn indigenous groups for carrying out whaling. A borderline case here are the Faroese, you know, the Faroe Islands, where you have the annual ritual of the Grindadrap, where the whales are killed off in fairly large numbers in a shallow bay, and the meat is portioned out collectively to the community, an old practice. But are the Faroese descendants of Norse people they speak a language which is sort of intermediate between Norwegian and Icelandic. Should they be considered an indigenous group? They've got iPhones. They study in Britain or Denmark or Norway. Hard to tell. So anyway, but I'll stop these musings now, and we'll I realize that we're you know running out of time. We run out of time sometime, but there are some parallels, and I'd like to at the end just to emphasize those parallels between the different forms of extinction, different forms of disappearance of diversity. There's a loss of flexibility that I mentioned, and think Bateson. One would take language, species, various cultural expressions, skills which are being lost, such as knowledge of endemic plants, which somehow is an embodied form of knowledge among many forest-dwelling peoples. And when those forest-dwelling peoples become plantation workers because the forest is gone, that knowledge also disappears. And much of it is orally transmitted. So it's not been recorded. There is a parallel here. I mean, and think about linguistic diversity. Yes, many species are disappearing, natural species, but languages. Today, one believes that around 7,000 languages are spoken in the world. 90% of them are expected to be extinct by 2050, which means that most of them are non-written. They're oral languages, and they're only spoken today by very few people, which a few generations ago would not have been the case. It's a fairly dramatic reduction of linguistic diversity. And if you believe, along with certain anthropologists and others, that every language produces its own vision, its own world, the language produces its own version of the world, many of these versions will be gone forever, unless we find ways of salvaging them. And that's one reason we have anthropology. Keep that in mind. I mean, anthropology has sometimes rightly been criticized for being some kind of colonial endeavor, but it is also a way of trying to give voice to people who otherwise would not have it. And today, to try to keep and maintain knowledge, insights, worldviews, life worlds, which are being overrun and destroyed by global overheating. So extinction and invasions, that this lecture has dealt with, embodied fairly central aspects of overheating. And I'm just mentioning them now. Simplification, you know, less diversity, less variation, homogeneity, standardization, accelerated change, yes. I mean, as I've spoken about at length, many of these changes took place in the pre-industrial or pre-conquest past, but more piecemeal and more slowly, right? And with not as dramatic consequences in most cases, and a loss of flexibility, which is a result of the simplification. And another thing they have in common is the human activities reshaping nature, both invasion and extinction of species, that we are geoengineering the planet. And it's a game with high stakes. Finally, a quotation from the geographer David Harvey, who, with an air of disappointment, after all he's a Marxist, says that, you know, it's easier now to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And that quotation, it stuck with me because there is a lot of truth to that. On this note, on this cheerful note, we end, and next week you go to meet Astrid Stensrud, who will talk about the anthropology of climate change. She's an old overheater who's been working for many years in Peru, main interest in water, and has done some great work on anthropology and climate. And among other things, she did 90% of the work in a book that she and I edited that was published last year, on climate, capitalism, and communities. So enjoy the lecture with Astrid next week, and we'll see each other in 2 weeks.